Hello, I'm Jason Solomons, and a very festive welcome to the final Film Weekly of 2008. On this week's show...
Well, no, can you imagine having to do all that sex? You know, sex in movies is not fun, because I have had some, you know, before, and there's a lot of people watching. Your butt is in the air. It's not the most fun.
Yes, as you can tell, actor Stephen Ray is not at all unhappy with the lack of on-screen sex in his film career. Stephen joins me to talk about his new film, Stuck, the perfect hangdog actor to convey the most miserable day possible. More of that in a moment. And...
I'm very interested, as well as rather anxious, about how they will feel about an Englishman having made this film.
A nervy Stephen Daldry there. I'll be asking what drew him to the thorny subject of German Holocaust guilt in his new film, The Reader. More of that later. And Zan Brooks will be joining me as ever, but not for reviews of the films. We'll be running down the year's best films, contrasting and comparing both our top 10 films of 2008. All that's to come on Film Weekly. Irish actor Stephen Ray is best known for his leading role as the unfortunate IRA man Fergus in Neil Jordan's The Crying Game, a role which brought him fame and Oscar-nominated cred in Hollywood. Ray began his career as a stage actor in Ireland and has managed to retain a very theatrical sort of presence on the big screen. In part, this explains why he's most often cast as either comic or tragic, from his role as Henry Miles in The End of the Affair to his hilarious Milo O'Branigan in Altman's Pret-a-Porter. In his latest incarnation as Thomas Bardo in Stuck, directed by Stuart Gordon and co-starring Mina Suvari, Stephen Ray balances his two sides very deftly. Stuck is based on a true story, and it tells of a car accident that sends its two central characters and their lives into a tailspin.
You.
Why are you doing this to me?
You want to kill me?
Just go to sleep, all right?
Help me.
I can't.
You can't leave me like this.
Please.
I'll tell them it was an accident. I will. You won't be in any trouble. Let me go. Let me go. Take me to a hospital. You can leave me a few blocks away. You don't even have to be there. I don't know you. I don't even know where I am.
Stephen Ray, thanks so much for joining us down the line for Film Weekly. Happy New Year to you over there in Ireland.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you, Jess.
What a good way to start the new year with a new movie coming out, Stuck. Although it's probably not a good place to start, because you're literally stuck in this movie. Half of it you spend in a windscreen of a car not being able to move. That must have been uncomfortable.
Yeah, because I was about 3 weeks lying on the hood of a car with my head through some broken glass. Yeah.
I'm watching it, I'm thinking, did he actually every morning have to sort of come into work? What are you doing today, love? Well, I'm going to have blood painted all over my face, glass inserted into various bits of my skin. I'm going to lie on a bonnet with my head through a window for all day.
Well, it did happen for several mornings, yeah. I mean, not always, because there were some scenes before the accident and there were some scenes when I actually got out of the position in the windshield. But a lot of the time it was that. And, of course, you know, I couldn't complain. Although I did, but I couldn't complain too much, because it's in the script, and if you don't like it, don't do it.
Yeah, know? No, absolutely. You know what it reminded me? I thought it was, people said it was like a Hitchcockian suspense, but actually it reminded me of Samuel Beckett. It's such a surreal situation.
Well, the writer, John Strizek, would be really, really thrilled to hear you say Samuel Beckett, because he's a huge fan of Samuel Beckett and deeply affected by him. And the director is, obviously anyone is, a Hitchcock fan. So I think they're both in there, you really, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, you've always been an interesting actor to watch, Stephen. As soon as you walk on screen, I think you've got one of the most distinctive presences. I wasn't going to say faces, because you kind of bring a whole kind of weariness to it as well.
I know.
And I thought, well, I wonder why they've cast him for this role. And then when I realised that you do spend half the film kind of with your head through the glass, I thought, oh, he's kind of got that expression anyway. He looks like he's just walked into a glass.
It looks like I've been hit by a car. Even before I've been hit by a car. Okay, thank you, Jason. Well, I know I have that, and I have nothing I can do about it. I'm not as miserable as I look, that's all I can tell you. But I suppose this is a character who's really on the way down, and he is miserable. He's just, life is falling in on top of him, and he doesn't know what to do about anything. And he's slipping through the cracks.
Mm. I wondered, Stephen, if that was something that you've ever experienced yourself. But then looking back, you've been working for so many years, really. I mean, if you go on IMDb, I don't know how true this is, but it starts with Crossroads back in 1964 and Z Cars.
Well, you know, I do go way back, you know, but I never felt as fragile as this character, you know? You know, most people's lives are more fragile than they know.
Mm.
That's what I kind of liked about this movie, is that he has lost everything, and then he's lying dying on this bonnet of this car, and he has to decide he's either going to die or he's going to fight back, and suddenly he finds the anger in himself to fight back.
Yeah, I enjoyed watching you find that, actually, because quite often in your films, sort of mentioned before, you seem resigned to it. I think of something like The End of the Affair, where you know you're put upon. You don't really kind of ever get to fight back. It's always nice to see a little bit of anger coming up in you, Stephen.
I know. Well, in The End of the Affair, though, what's interesting about that character is that in a strange way, he possesses, not that either of the two men possess Julianne Moore's character, really, because nobody but God in that movie actually possesses her. But he possesses him more than Rafe's character, because he loves her more.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. It's a heartbreaking turn in that film, I think, Stephen. I think people forget, because of Rafe gets to have much more sex than you in that film. But you actually get the heartbreak.
I didn't have any.
No. I mean, you should have. You know, you want to speak to your agent about that. You know, more sex, please.
Well, no, can you imagine having to do all that sex? You know, sex in movies is not fun. It's because I have had some, you know, before. And it's just, there's a lot of people watching. And your butt is in the air. It's not really it's not the most fun, you know.
Yeah. Now, I suppose as you approach, with all due respect, a sort of a more mature period in your career, if I don't get to see your buttocks, that's probably some blessed relief.
You'd be much happier, I understand.
Yeah, absolutely. Stephen, let's talk about let's go back a bit on your career. Seeing you throughout the 80s in your Neil Jordan collaborations, you quickly became such a sort of familiar face in British cinema. Was that the plan, or you just kind of kept taking the jobs and mixing them with theatre that you were doing in Dublin?
There was no plan, just to keep going, you know, just keep acting, keep working. I didn't have, I really never believed that I would be in a movie, because, I mean, I only started acting in the theatre because there were no movies to be in.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got really caught up in theatre, and then suddenly Neil Jordan said to me, look, I'm going to do a movie. I knew him just as a novelist, you know, so we were kind of just Irish theatre and literary guys, and suddenly he said, I'm going to do a movie, and would you like to be in it? And I thought, well, it's fantastic. At least I'll get to do one movie in my whole life, you know. And then, of course, Neil, being Neil, had a career, and so I went along with him, and eventually The Crying Game came along, and kind of, you know, we were all suddenly in America and everything, and people were noticing us. And
well, you were there Oscar night, weren't you, really, which
is
great fun.
So, I mean, and the great thing about the Americans, even though I know it's a lot of old nonsense, really, the Oscar thing, is that if you've been nominated, they remember you, and they believe you are somebody. They don't, I mean, we Europeans tend to forget. You just think, well, who the hell is that, you know, who cares? That was 14, 15 years ago. No, but actually, they do care in America. It's important to them.
It counts for something, yeah. I'm wondering how, if because you were in Neil's first film, he's kept you sort of in every film. Kind of, are you like his lucky charm? And if he does a film without you, he thinks it will collapse.
Well, someone said to him once, "Is Stephen in all your movies?" And he said, "No, he's in all my good movies." He said ruefully, you know. I mean, I've just done my 10th movie with him in the summer.
What's that? Is that Ondine?
Ondine with Colin Farrell. And, I love working with him. If I do 9 movies, I don't expect 10. I don't expect to be in number 11. I don't think that way.
Mate, absolutely wonderful for you to join us on
Lovely
Film Weekly.
To talk to you,
congratulations too. On Stuck. And we'll see you again soon.
Thanks a lot.
Cheers.
Good luck. God bless.
Stephen Ray there. He's not half as miserable as he looks, is he? My huge thanks to him. And Stuck is out on Friday, the 9th of January. You're listening to the final edition of Film Weekly for 2008 with me, Jason Solomons. Joining me now is Film Weekly regular, Guardian critic at large, and General Scrooge, Zan Brooks. Welcome back, Zan. This week, we're summing up the best films of 2008 with our top 10s. That's mine and yours. I've got to say that both lists will be posted on the Guardian website and on our Facebook page. And before we kick off, I thank everyone who's joined our Film Weekly fans group. We've had some brilliant postings already. Graham Fulton from Glasgow posted that he loved Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, Jar City, The Lookout, and Herzog's Encounters at the End of the World. Film Weekly fan Jennifer Singh has posted. She says, Mamma Mia was brilliant. Oh, sure, the singing wasn't all that great, but you left the theatre smiling and singing an ABBA tune. So you see, we do savour your thoughts and views on all the films we cover. Why not make it your New Year's resolution to join the Film Weekly fans group on Facebook? Back to the task in hand. Zan, let's discuss the films that made it onto the 10th position in our top 10. Guests first, Zan. What film is number 10 on your best films of 2008?
My number 10, in with a bullet, is Sweeney Todd.
Oh, guess what?
Yes, I know. I'm looking at the list now.
It's on my number 10 as well. Sweeney Todd.
We like those synchronised swimmers,
aren't we? Like
Johnny
Depp and Helena Bonham Carter at this moment.
Well, I really liked Sweeney
Todd. I liked it too.
And it was quite weird because there was a lot of kind of buzz around it when it looked like it was going to clean up at the Oscars. And then it kind of failed to get a Best Picture nomination. And then it felt like people had just kind of dropped it. It's a failure.
Yeah.
I mean,
Johnny Depp sort of got a Best Actor nod. But I think they didn't really handle it very well back.
It was a very difficult film to handle, though, wasn't it? I think it did okay at the box office, but it certainly was a film that kind of, I think, took people by surprise a little bit.
So why did you and I like it? I mean, I like a musical more than I would
say you.
I don't
like musicals. Yeah. And maybe I liked it because of the fact that Johnny Depp can't sing for hell, really. It sounds like hell when he sings. And I kind of liked that sort of gung-ho abandon of it. I thought it really kind of just threw everything at the screen. It had total confidence in its own ludicrousness. And because of that, it achieved something and it sucked you in. And it was a great kind of pageant, great kind of, you know, big circus going on.
Yeah, I really like it. And it didn't have big dance numbers and it didn't have Pierce Brosnan, and it didn't, you know, but it did
and
have
it was
Alan Rickman,
dark and
you know,
bloody as hell.
It was really, I think it was an 18 certificate, which is an amazing thing for a musical.
I know.
At number 9, Zan Brooks.
At number 9 is a very, very different film, again, sort of set in a city that is slightly kind of reimagined. It's Terence Davis's of Time in the City, which is his love letter / hate letter to the Liverpool of his youth, and his comment on the Liverpool of today. You know, Terence Davis is typically held up as, you know, the great British filmmaker who can't actually get any money to make a film.
Yeah.
And this was the first thing that he's actually done for about sort of 8 years.
Yeah, the first thing. And it only cost $250,000, and it was commissioned to celebrate Liverpool's year as European City of Culture.
And it's a very small film. It's basically just archive footage with him waxing lyrical over it. But as a sort of tour guide of Liverpool, he's fascinating company. It's wildly subjective. It's basically, this isn't pretending to be an overview of Liverpool history in the post-war period. This is Liverpool as Terence Davis saw it.
Strangely, my number 9 is also about childhood, but a sort of different kind of approach to childhood. I've gone for Son of Rambo.
Yeah.
The film by Garth Jennings, which is about two little boys who make a little lo-fi version of Rambo in the woods behind the back of one of their houses. Great little performances from the kids, Bill Milner and Will Poulter there. And I just thought it captured sort of playing around in the 80s.
Our youth, I guess.
Yeah, I know.
The youth of the filmmakers too. I like this a lot. This was a good kind of solid little British film. I wouldn't say it would be in my top 10, but I was very fond of it.
Yeah, it's fondness that has got it to number 9. I'm softened at this time of the year. So, and let's move on to number 8.
I'm going for a time motif. After Of Time in the City, we have Times and Winds.
Wow, good choice.
Which was a very strange Turkish film by a director called Rehe Erdem, who I've never seen anything else that he's done.
No, me neither.
And maybe we'll never see anything else that he does from now on. He's certainly one of the more obscure Turkish filmmakers. This is a sort of peasant village saga. It's kind of intertwined stories. It's a sort of coming of age fable. It reminded me a little bit of, you know, Carson McCullough's novel The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, in that it was very kind of bleak.
It was.
But it had a kind of poetry to it.
Very beautiful.
It's set in this kind of mountainous region with a great Arvo Part soundtrack. I mean, this is pure art house cinema, but I thought it had a real kind of power and an authenticity.
And it was about fathers and sons and how generations of hardship are handed on.
Yeah, there's
on
a lot of hardship in there and a lot of people kind of riven by the class system, riven by the sexism of their society, and all kind of basically trapped. But it was a brilliant sort of stark portrait of this world.
Yeah, it was. I enjoyed that film as well, Times and Winds. In fact, there was another Turkish film that didn't make my list, but I want to give a little shout to by Fatih Akin this year, called Edge of Heaven, which I thought was rather terrific as well, and had that sort of rhythm. He's a German filmmaker, but he's Turkish as well, as you were saying that your guy was one of the more obscure Turkish filmmakers. I don't know who on earth you mean are some of the most famous.
Well, is that Nuri Bilge Ceylan? son. Yes. He's like a superstar yeah. in Turkey.
He's the Ron Howard of Turkey. My number eight, I'm sort of staying Eastern, but I'm moving into Romania with 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days.
Yes.
But that's on your list as well.
That's on my
list
and higher up.
Right,
so we'll talk about
we'll
it
talk
then.
About it there. That's a Cannes winner from a year ago. So I'm going to move on to seven, and I'll give you my number seven. It's Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, a film by Sidney Lumet, who at the age of 175 is still churning them out. Absolutely brilliant thriller starring Philip Seymour Hoffman, Ethan Hawke, who I don't normally like, and Marisa Tomei, and yeah. a thriller about brothers set in New York that tightens and tightens until you can hardly breathe.
Yeah,
I loved it.
Great. Why isn't Lumet seen as a better director?
I know. I mean, if you think
he's done like pound for pound, he's done probably more great films than anyone bar Scorsese. Maybe,
yes, we talk about the 12
years.
Angry Men.
Well, right back to 12 Angry Men, and then right through to things like Dog Day Afternoon
Brilliant.
And The Verdict,
Serpico.
And, he's a
I think
master.
It was something to do with The Wiz. Because he made that as well for no reason.
We
I think
maybe
people just went, no, I'm sorry, mate, stop. So what was at your number seven, Dan?
My number seven was a very different film called Garage, which was an Irish film by Lenny Abrahamson.
Oh, a lovely film, actually.
Which was set in the west of Ireland and featured a fantastic performance from Pat Short.
He's hilarious.
Yeah, as a sort of slow-witted, decent kind of loser who works at this sort of local shabby filling station. And it's a real slice of life. And what I think it got right is that so many films have the kind of the slow-witted, holy fool hero, and they sentimentalise them and make them real unrealistic. Whereas this shows that these people have a sexual side. It doesn't go away because you're a bit slow-witted, and it gets you into trouble.
Yeah.
And this film kind of nailed that and felt real to me.
Let's move on to your number six, Zan, please.
My number six, you have higher, which is it's There Will Be Blood.
Yes, I do have higher, but how high? Well, let's discuss that when we get there on my list. We did talk about There Will Be Blood in our special DVD in the sock gift selection.
Yes,
which
Catherine was a big fan of it.
Yes, which went out last week.
Catherine, I remember her saying it was one of the best films ever made.
Ever made. Maybe we should put it higher on our list. Our number six only, Zan. The best film ever made. You've demoted to six. What are we going to do? I'll give you my number six, which is In Search of a Midnight Kiss.
Yeah, I like this too.
This is a walking around LA, two lovers trying to meet on New Year's Eve. So I thought topical for an end of year list. And I gave it a little kiss by being an opposite. I really enjoyed this film. I thought it was funny. I thought it was returned to that sort of lo-fi American indie filmmaking.
Yeah,
we haven't seen the
American indie
of
film
for ages.
Has kind of died, hasn't it? Really? It's been sort of sucked into the major studios with their sort of little boutique wings.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, you've got the sort of the mumblecore movement, which hasn't really caught on.
Because it's not very good.
It's not very good.
Is it?
I've seen Hannah Takes the Stairs and it wasn't great.
No.
But this kind of had that spirit. It had that sort of airy lightness. And a kind of sharpness to it too,
and a nice sexy turn I thought from Sarah Simmons, an actress I'd never heard.
I've never heard of any actress.
And I thought it was beautiful photography as well. And you saw downtown LA, which is not somewhere you see. So it sort of did to downtown LA what Gordon Willis did to Woody Allen's Manhattan.
Yeah,
I think. And it does start out with one of the great cinematic masturbation gags. So for that reason alone, it shoots
alone.
Up to number six in my list. Zan, where are you with your number five?
My number five is a documentary by James Marsh. Called Man on Wire.
Oh, that's on my list too.
Oh, it's on your list?
Yes.
It's even higher
it
on
is
your
high.
List.
Wow, a well, high wire act for Man on Wire. Let's come back to that
let's
then.
Stand on the precipice with that for a
I'll
bit.
I'll give you my number five, which sort of reflects back to your old number nine, Your of Time in the City. I'll give you Your of Time in the City at a moment, and I'll raise you to number five for My Winnipeg, Guy Maddon's docu-fantasia about his childhood growing up in Winnipeg.
What do you know of Winnipeg, Jason?
All I know is that his Winnipeg is very similar to my Stanmore, which is rather bizarre. But I think that what I thought was amazing about this film is the more specific you get, the more universal it seems. And there's a few films about childhood. I mentioned Son of Rambo, number nine. And this one went into how, you know, he makes up his childhood. And this is what I think filmmakers very rarely do so obviously or so brazenly, is sort of say, it's my film, I'm going to lie. I'm going to cast Anne Savage, who was a B-movie actress, as my mum, slightly barking and insane. I'm going to tell you, this may or may not be true, and you never want to go to Winnipeg, but he has a love-hate relationship with this, as I think we all do with our past. My Winnipeg is incidentally out on DVD, as are most of these, and most of them have featured on Film Weekly at various points in the year. You can find the list on our website. We are going down our lists of 2008. We've reached the halfway stage. Zan, let's push on and upwards to your number four. 4 of the year.
My number 4 was your number 8, which is 4 months, 3 weeks and 2 days. Which
the Ted Rogers film.
Which won at Cannes last year, wasn't it? 2007?
It was, yeah. It feels a long time ago.
Christian Mungio's Romanian abortion drama set during the Ceausescu regime in the sort of late 1980s. This is like one of those films that you could almost hold this up as a template for low-budget filmmaking in that it doesn't have a kind of wasted breath, wasted scene. It knows exactly what it's doing, and it just kind of goes for it and gets there. And again, like with Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, it's a film that just tightens by degrees till you just feel that you can't breathe and the walls
yes,
are closing
I mean,
in.
Not only does he not waste a breath, I almost kind of forgot to breathe myself in it. There's one scene in 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days, which is sort of a tangential scene. It kind of stops the action. She goes for dinner with her sort of boyfriend's parents.
Parents, and it's suddenly a very respectable dinner, and you know that there's this nightmare unfolding halfway across town that she needs to get back to kind of supervise.
It's my favourite scene of the year, I think.
It's one of the great scenes.
Critics always kind of hailed 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days. It was harder to convince audiences that it was a masterpiece, I think.
Well, I think, you know, I'll put it on the poster, an abortion film set in communist Romania. Isn't the ideal kind of date movie, perhaps.
No, it certainly isn't.
And yet it was so well acted and so convincing. And, you know, it's a thriller, basically. Mm. It's a thriller, and it thrills.
Yeah, I thought so. 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days, your number 4 film of the year, Zan. I will match you with us on another Cannes success, but from this year at my number 4 was the film Gomorrah. Which I notice is at your number 3.
So we can kind of talk about it now.
Let's talk about it now.
Let's just nudge up to 3.
Yeah, let's nudge up to your 3, Gomorrah.
Gomorrah, I know, was one of our favourite films at Cannes this year, and perhaps should have won the main prize, although The Class was also a superb film.
Yes, we'll talk about that next year.
And Gomorrah is Matteo Garrone's film about the Neapolitan mafia, based on the book by Roberto Saviano, that Saviano is now living a life in hiding for blowing the whistle. We've spoken about this on the show, but it feels like sort of at Cannes, when it was released, and again now. But it's worth saying.
And I had the director Matteo Garrone on both times, once in Italian and then once in English, because he seemed to have improved over the year. So he gets the E for Effort prize.
And it's just superb. It's one of the great gangster movies of our time, I think. You know, as we've said, it's not a film that glamorizes this. It shows the way it works, and it shows the sort of the human cost and the casualties.
Gomorrah, my number 4, your number 3. My number 3 is There Will Be Blood, which you've had on your list at number 6, but I put it down number 3, even though it was last year's Oscar contender. I do think that the more I think about this film, and I think maybe that's why we talked about memory, the act of memory, it's what stays with you, isn't it? And There Will Be Blood, I just find that's lodged in the memory. And as you mentioned, Catherine Shaw thinks it's one of the great films ever made, and I think she might have a point. I think in time it will be seen as such an extraordinary film that it looks and sounds
it
like
is extraordinary.
No
other. It's bold, it's brilliant, it has a superb performance from Daniel Day-Lewis, which is wildly over the top but completely fitting given the surroundings.
I've
of the
abandoned
film.
My child.
What my one slight problem with this film, which is why it isn't even higher, is that I think that the character of Eli, the preacher, was not enough of a foil to Daniel Day-Lewis. If Paul Thomas Anderson is making a film about the twin gods of America, which are, you know, the church and oil, then you need a slightly stronger, more formidable nemesis for the Day-Lewis character. And I don't think Eli quite was that.
Well, no,
that's my slight problem with
the film. He has his milkshake taken off him.
He had his milkshake taken, and it ends badly for him. Of course, it ends badly for Day-Lewis too.
Brilliant.
But it was a great, great film.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've reached the number 2, the top 2s on our best films of 2008 here on Film Weekly. Zan Brooks, lay yours on me.
My number 2 is No Country for Old Men.
I've been
banging on about
God
this.
God, blimey.
I apologise.
Since you're a young man.
I apologise. But, you know, this is the end of year, so this is the last time I'll ever talk about it ever again. This was, I think, one of the few times where I watched the Oscars and just thought, my God, they've got it so right.
I was with you. I remember the night. You were so excited.
And I thought, what does this say about me? Does this show that I'm becoming a kind of conservative Academy member? That I'll give it to Chicago.
The significance was that this is quite an unusual Oscar winner.
Oscars, wasn't it? With Daniel Day-Lewis winning Best Actor for There Will Be Blood, and then this film winning Best Picture, when it is a dark, nasty, unpleasant, unrelenting basically a B movie. Mm. It's a kind of the best B movie you will ever see.
Yeah.
And again, like with 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, it doesn't have a kind of an ounce of fat on it. It's lean and sharp and mean.
It's the craft that I really enjoyed about that. It's the Coen brothers at their best writing and almost at their best, most fluid filmmaking.
Yeah, and the Coen brothers have kind of gone a bit off the rails recently. And I wasn't a big fan of Burn After Reading, which came after this. But here they've got the novel by Cormac McCarthy that I think kind of inspired them to make perhaps their finest film ever. I kind of love The Big Lebowski, which is very, very different.
Yes, in a rambling way.
But I sort of think for pound, this is their finest work.
Yeah, and to give them their dues, they've been very respectful of the source novel and sort of said, yeah, it's a great film. Because if it is a great film, which they never admit, they say if it's good, it's because the novel was brilliant.
It's true, and I've read the novel, and I actually think the film improves very, very marginally on the novel in that they just trim it just perfectly.
Wonderful cinematography, of course, from Roger Deakins, who I know you're a big fan of too. My number two, Zan, was your number five, so we're not too far. You could string a very small wire between our two choices there. It is Man on Wire, James Marsh's reconstruction of Philippe Petit's high wire walk between the Twin Towers of New York on a chilly morning in 1974. I thought this was extraordinary.
This was incredible, wasn't it? And this was another film that came out of left field and really kind of caught people by surprise.
Yeah, I was absolutely... I'm like anyone who might have witnessed that actual event on the morning of 1974, looking up at 1,500 feet above them, seeing a man. Is that a tightrope walker? I was like, oh my God. My neck was strained. I had butterflies in my stomach looking over the edge.
But also, it's a film about magic, isn't it, in a way? It's a film about sort of performance art that becomes this almost like sort of childlike explosion of delight that he did it because it was there.
Yeah.
And there was no kind of cynicism about it at all, really. It was just a kind of a thing that he did.
Yes, and he's clearly slightly insane.
Oh, of course.
And
he
makes great company. I mean, I don't normally like French mimes and that sort of
thing. No, I don't think many people do. I think it's a myth.
Maybe everyone was going, you're a mime, fall off, my God. But, you know, I like the way that James Marsh reconstructs it as well, like a heist movie. As you say, there's the daring of it. Reminding you of Rafifi.
Yeah.
And the way that they kind of made these kind of shadowy figures break in. He had a team of experts helping him. And also the way that the Twin Towers, which obviously loom extremely large on there. Well, they're gone now, of course, so this feat can never be repeated.
No.
And also, they didn't go all Twin Towers, which, as we know, were kind
exactly,
of raised to the ground.
Exactly. But it's there. Everyone knows it. Everyone knows the significance of it. And because of that, it becomes this kind of weird utopia that's already in the past, where you could do something crazy like that on the great expression of capitalism of that time, and now it's all kind of gone.
Yeah, like it is just a memory, and then people sort of think, did I witness that? Did that actually happen? It is like a dream, this film, and it's vanished now forever, but well preserved by James Marsh. We get to our number ones, Zan. Your number one film of 2008, Zan Brooks, if you
My
please.
Number one film, and it was a kind of a tricky choice because I think it has been a pretty good year for movies.
Well, when you always think, well, while you're going through the year, this is a terrible year, I'm stuck in it. And then you look back and you come up with a list like that and you think, God, I've watched all of those again and recommend them to everyone
Absolutely.
I love.
So my number one by a whisker, I think, is Waltz with Bashir, which is Ari Folman's animated reconstruction film about memory, an exorcism, I guess, of his time in the Israeli army where he stood by during a massacre of Palestinian civilians in 1982, or did he, you know, and he's not quite sure, so he's exploring. This is, you know, I know that you're no great fan of animation, and I'm kind of, you know, ambivalent at times, but I thought that this was the perfect vessel for this film.
Yes, this seemed the proper use of it to me, because as you say, it was like a dream, it was like memory. And I also always think that something like, you know, Dark Knight or animation aren't the proper place to discuss, you know, guilt and war and existential dread, but it managed it perfectly in Waltz with Bashir.
Yeah.
Zan, I'm going to give you my number one film of the year. I'm going to lay it on you now. It is Couscous by Abdellatif Kechiche. It won way back in February. It won four César, which are the French Oscars. And it absolutely took me by the scruff of the neck, this film, more than any other film this year. And I thought it was brilliant. It's about a man called Slimane, who lives in a port town of Sète near Marseille, who dreams of one last shot of making it as an immigrant in France. And he thinks he's going to open up a couscous restaurant on a disused barge. And he has to go round all the kind of dignitaries of this town and get loans, and he's turned away because basically he's an Arab, and the latent racism of all these kind of bourgeois bank managers, who he then invites to his opening night, who go and go, oh, it's not bad, this Chris really, but he gets all his family to help him out, and there's a bit of a divorce, and all life is in this film. It is a melting pot film, literally the melting pot of the couscous image, the actual kind of tagine pot that you have in there. And I thought it had everything that you want in there. It was a very long film, and it was released as The Secret of the Grains, or La Graine et le Moulet in French, and then they changed the name here to kind of give it a little bit more kind of snap, if you like. Yeah. I don't know if it particularly worked. People who've seen it do fall in love with it, but you have to go under its spell. There is a hypnotic belly dance by an actress called Hafsia Herzi in it, which won her Best Newcomer at Venice last year.
Because I have to actually confess at this point, I feel that you've kind of obscurely won some contest, because I haven't seen Couscous.
Right.
So you've kind of trumped me with this. I should suddenly pluck out a film that I know you haven't seen and put that as my new number one, just to kind of, we have a stalemate. So if you're saying it may not work and some people resist it, what is it about it that people struggle with?
I do think it's the length, and I think there are certain scenes that are quite shrill and painful, including the climax, which I think is both brilliant and heartbreaking at the same time. And it's balancing the two, cutting between, and you're thinking, oh, come on, what's going to happen? Oh, come on. But, I mean, the daring of it, again, it's a bit like 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days. If there are people who don't like that, because it's almost painful to watch at places because of the length that the director's doing, the confidence he's
and
having.
And the humiliation that's meted out.
Onto characters. Yeah. So there is that kind of recognition factor, that cringe, and you don't know who you are here. You're kind of part of the white bourgeoisie who have been kind of so neglectful. But there's also sort of other Arabs in the community who are also disdainful of him. So I have a feeling you will like it.
It does sound kind of great. I do want to see it.
It also has a great food scene, like that Christy Munju scene where they're eating. There's a great Sunday dinner, which someone said, I didn't like that film because all the characters ate with their mouths open. It was extremely impolite. And I said, well, if you've gone round to some peasant's dinner with 18 like North Africans around, they're going to be passing the peppers and the fish. That's how Sunday dinner is around
my
place.
What a criteria not to like a film. They eat with their mouths open. Caney eats with his mouth open. That's no film.
Get out of here. Impolite films. So that is my film of 2008. I realise it's not a left field choice at all. I mean, Waltz of Bashir and Couscous, they both come sort of on that kind of Semitic Arabo line.
Yeah.
With a bit of French involvement.
So we kind
of
started in synchronisation with Sweeney Todd, and we're kind of ending kind of in the same way.
In the same step as well. And I do recommend both of those films to anyone. Couscous is out on a DVD. Waltz of Bashir, not quite yet, because it was only recently released. But again, films that we heartily recommend here on Film Weekly. We hope you have enjoyed our rundown of films of 2008. We have reviewed most of them throughout the year, so do catch up with our old shows. Zan, it remains for me to wish you a very happy new year.
You too, and I shall see you in 2009.
This week sees the release of British director Stephen Daldry's third theatrical feature film, The Reader. Daldry has already become one of the most established directors in Britain. In part, it's due to the fact of Billy Elliot being a huge critical and commercial success, embedding itself into the language and culture of modern Britain and becoming a successful stage musical both here in London and in New York. Since then, Daldry has directed The Hours, starring an Oscar-winning Nicole Kidman in A Large Nose. However, his new film, The Reader, enters darker territory, with this story of an SS concentration camp guard, Hannah Schmitz, played by Kate Winslet, who's eventually tried for war crimes in post-war Germany. The story is seen, partly in flashback, through the eyes of her former lover, Michael, played by Ralph Fiennes, who falls in love with Hannah as a teenager, only for her to disappear. 8 years later, as Michael is a law student attending the Nazi trials, Hannah unexpectedly re-emerges. When I met up with Stephen Daldry, I started out by asking if he was daunted by the subject matter. But first, let's hear a short clip from The Reader.
What are you studying in German?
I'm studying a play by a writer called Gotthold Ephraim Lessing. Have you heard of him? The play's called Emilia Galotti. You can read it.
I'd rather listen to you.
All right. Act 1, Scene 1. The setting, one of the prince's chambers. The prince. Not very good.
Go on.
Complaints. Nothing but complaints. For goodness sake, is there anything in life but work?
I didn't approach it with trepidation. I love Bernard Schlink's book, and which are somebody had given me, Josephine Hart actually gave me the book to read, and I loved it. And it's a subject which I'd always been fascinated with, the sort of odyssey of post-war Germany.
You're not a German filmmaker. It was a German novel, of course, but you're an international filmmaker, and it was internationally produced, and you had an international star in Kate Winslet. Was there a sense that you lend a different perspective to it coming from a foreign angle?
Well, we haven't shown the film in Germany yet. We'll take it to the Berlin Film Festival. And I'm very interested, as well as rather anxious, about this book, which is so well known and so important. It's even taught in schools. How they will feel about an Englishman having made this film. I think that when I first had the opportunity to make it, I did go and talk to Bernard Schlink and say, why are you not doing this in German? You know, why not with a German filmmaker? Why do you want this done in English at all? And I think he genuinely was interested to know whether the subject matter would resonate outside of the specific context of post-war Germany.
Mm. Let's talk about Kate Winslet, because it seems to me that when you make your films, if we think about the hours as well, you find your lead actress, in that case Nicole Kidman, in this case, let's say Kate Winslet, and that becomes a departing point for you. It sort of sets the tone for you as a director. You know where you can go. Are you guided by actresses like that?
Well, I mean, one of the great joys working in the theatre is you obviously work very closely with actors over a very long period of time, and it's quite a long process of investigation and rehearsal.
Now, that's unusual for directors to say that, normally they sort of turn up with their crew and then maybe a week's rehearsal, but I get the feeling that you do a lot more.
Yes, I really do need to rehearse, and the great thing about Kate is that she also loves, I mean, she does an astonishing amount of prep, which I love to do, and investigation and indeed rehearsal.
I'm interested too that with Nicole Kidman in The Hours, of course, you famously used makeup to kind of alter her quite magnificently, I think. But the nose got quite a lot of attention at the time. Didn't matter; she still won an Oscar. That was wonderful. And again, you made the decision quite boldly here with Kate to age Kate Winslet rather than find an older actress. You've used makeup again to age Kate. Is that a decision you wrestle over, or is it just quite obvious? You know, you just ask Kate to play older.
It wasn't a decision I wrestled with, no. I always thought that character had to be played by one actress all the way through. I think it did cross my mind whether we needed to find a little old lady who would be her. But then that was very soon dismissed. And we went through a very long process and a very complicated process of testing different techniques and different possibilities with the aging, including a body that allowed Kate to move and feel the weight of the change of gravity.
But you said there are prosthetic bodies that you can...
A prosthetic body that had the correct weight ratio and did change how Kate walked and indeed felt. And a lot of the time we used photographs actually of her grandmother to see how her grandmother looked, mm-hmm. as a sort of guideline to create Kate as an old lady.
Well, that's fascinating, I think. It's also a fascinating film, I think, because one of the things one notices, although I didn't notice it until the end, but it was something that was kind of troubling me throughout, is that you've got two different cinematographers. You use Roger Deakins, I think, for the old bit, and the great Chris Menges for the modern bit. When did you decide to use that approach? Because it's quite unusual.
Well, that wasn't... the process of having two DOPs was because we started shooting. When we started shooting, although I had gone to Kate originally with Miss Bernisch-Link, asked her to play it, she wasn't available, so when we started shooting, Nicole Kidman was going to be playing Hannah. And then Nicole got pregnant, and so we stopped. And then I went back to Kate, who was then free at that point, and said, look, if we put on a hiatus, will you come and play this part? And then she was free, so she came. But that delay meant that Roger had to go off onto another movie, and his friend, and my old friend Chris Menges, came in to do, in fact, what was the body of the movie.
Oh, I see. So it wasn't. I thought it was because Roger.
It was not planned.
Certain textures that Roger does well, and Chris does the kind of urban stuff well.
No, but that would be a much better answer. But no, it was because it was purely scheduling and actressing.
A big thank you to Stephen Daldry there, and you can watch a version of that interview by going to guardian.co.uk/inthedirectorschair, alongside interviews with such luminaries as Baz Luhrmann, Gurinder Chadha, Alex Gibney, and Mark Forster. All of them feature as part of my series In the Director's Chair. Thanks also to my other guests this week, to Zan Brooks and to the great Stephen Ray. That's all we've got for you this week, and indeed for this year. So thanks to all our contributors, our colleagues, our friends of the show, and of course our listeners in 2008. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye and a very happy new year. We'll see you in 2009.